stars and stripes. Dumpster fire vibe. Come on. All American why? All American why? All American why? Ask yourself the American why.
Hello, excessive thinkers. Before we talk to our guests today, we need to lay some groundwork because this episode is not about theory. It's about real people whose lives are being treated like political punchlines. Let's start with something that is historically, factually, and humanly true. Trans people have always existed. In the United States, we can point to people like Dr. Alan L. Hart, a pioneering physician in the early 20th century who lived as a man and helped advance tuberculosis screening. We can talk about Christine Jorgensen, whose transition in the 1950s became national news and forced the country, very uncomfortably, to admit that trans people were not a theory, but real people living real lives. And we can talk about Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera, who were central to the modern LGBTQ plus rights movement after Stonewall and were still pushed to the margins even by their own allies. We should also remember moments like Compton's cafeteria riot in 1966, when trans women and gender non-conforming people in San Francisco fought back against police harassment years before Stonewall. Or the long history of cross-dressing laws and three-article rules that let police arrest people just for wearing the wrong clothes. Or the Lavender Scare, when the United States government purged LGBTQ plus people from public service as supposed security risks. Or how trans women, especially trans women of color, were hit hard by the AIDS crisis and then largely erased from the story of that era altogether. And that is just the version of history we usually tell in the United States. Around the world, many cultures have recognized more than two genders for centuries. And in some of those cultures, people who are trans, non-binary, or gender diverse are seen not as problems to be solved, but as special, as sacred, as worthy of respect and celebration. Two-spirit identities in many indigenous nations are often understood as carrying unique spiritual or social roles. Hijra communities in South Asia have long held ceremonial and cultural roles. Fa'afafin, and excuse my language for not pronouncing that correctly, in Samoa are often deeply integrated into family and community life. Mahu in Hawaii and Tahiti have historically been recognized as caretakers and teachers. These are not trends. They are not social media inventions. They are real human beings and part of human history. And then there are intersex people whose bodies alone challenge the idea that sex is a neat, simple binary. Medical experts estimate that around 1 to 2% of people are born with intersex traits involving natural variations in chromosomes, hormones, or anatomy. People like to talk about trans, non-binary, intersex, and gender-expansive people as if they're some tiny fringe. And in one sense, that's true in a very specific way. A lot of the people who are loudest in hating them have probably never knowingly met a trans or non-binary person in their lives. It is easy to turn someone into a caricature when they only exist in your head or on a screen. The Williams Institute at UCLA estimates that about 2.8 million people in the United States, roughly 1% of people aged 13 and older, identify as transgender or non-binary, and that about 3.3% of U.S. teens do. Those same researchers are clear that these numbers are probably underestimates because many surveys still do not ask good questions about gender identity, and many people do not feel safe answering them honestly. So yes, they may feel like a fringe to someone whose world is small or insulated. But in reality, they are your neighbors, your coworkers, your classmates, your family members, and in many cases, the people who already make your life work without you even realizing it. For decades and still today, in many places, including the United States, intersex infants and children have been subjected to non-consensual, medically unnecessary surgeries to make their bodies fit social expectations of male or female. These procedures, often done long before a person can consent, and they carry lifelong physical and psychological consequences. This is not a theory. This is documented medical harm done in the name of enforcing a binary that nature itself doesn't even follow. Add in binary and gender expansive people who have always been here too. What is changing is not who people are, but whether they're allowed to be honest and visible. And part of what changes over time is language. Not because people are being trendy, but because we finally get better words for things that have always existed. So the real question is not, why do these people exist? They always have. The real question is, why is America so obsessed with turning gender into a moral panic? We saw this play out loudly in the 2024 election, with fear-based ads trying to turn trans people into a political weapon. Donald Trump and his allies ran ads attacking Vice President Kamala Harris, claiming that she wanted to turn everyone trans who was in prison, as if gender identity were some kind of contagious punishment you could impose on people. It was absurd, it was dishonest, and it was designed to scare people, not to inform them. And this is just one campaign or one moment. We have seen governors like Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott turn trans people into policy targets. We have seen figures like Kristi Noem, Mike Johnson, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Josh Hawley, and Ted Cruz use trans people as recurring symbols in culture war politics. Again, this is not fringe. This is part of how power is being exercised. We've also seen a media ecosystem built around this panic. Matt Walsh, Tucker Carlson, Ben Shapiro, Charlie Kirk, and the Turning Point Universe spent years framing trans people as a threat to society, especially around schools, bathrooms, and healthcare. It is not only politicians and pundits. We've also seen cultural figures with massive platforms, like J.K. Rowling, who built a career telling us to stand up to bullies and then decided to become one herself. And that same fear shows up in everyday conversations too. You hear people say that they're afraid their child will go to school and somehow catch the trans, like it's a virus floating in the hallway. This is not how identity works. This isn't how any of this works. And here is where the religious rhetoric comes in, because a lot of the loudest voices in this panic also claim the moral high ground. They say that they're defending Christian values. They say that they're doing this in the name of God. But let's be honest for a second. A good Christian does not build policy around cruelty. A good Christian does not humiliate their neighbors. A good Christian does not turn entire groups of people into political threats. Whether you believe in science, God, Mother Earth, the Big Bang Theory, some, none, or all of the above, one thing is still true. We are all related and we're all part of the same human story. And if you believe in a creator, then here's a pretty unavoidable conclusion. If God created people like this, then God wanted people like this to exist. Honestly, one of the most godly things a person can do, right up there with caring for the planet and caring for each other, is to be who they are. Not who fear or other people tell them to be, not who politics demands they pretend to be, but to be exactly as they are. And yet, here we are. We have politicians like Nancy Mace and others turning bathrooms into a cultural war battlefield. We have bathroom bans that pretend to be about safety while doing absolutely nothing to make anyone safer. And a whole lot to make life more dangerous and humiliating for trans, non-binary, intersex, and gender-expansive people who literally just want to use the restroom and get on with their day. And here is something that gets lost in this conversation. These laws actually make things more dangerous for cis women too. When you invite strangers, security, or police to start policing who looks like they belong in the bathroom or not, you create more harassment, more confrontations, and more opportunities for real predators to exploit confusion. You turn bathrooms into surveillance spaces instead of safe spaces. You increase the risk of violence rather than reduce it. And again, here is the part that really exposes how unserious all of this is. You already use gender-neutral bathrooms. You have one in your house. You use them on airplanes. You use them in single-stall restrooms all over the place. Somehow, mysteriously, society has not collapsed. The plane still lands and your house is still standing. And when the exact same concept shows up in public policy, suddenly it's treated like the end of civilization. And bathrooms are not the only front in this. We are also seeing healthcare bans targeting gender-affirming care, even though major medical associations support it. We're seeing sports bans built around vanishingly small numbers of athletes. We're seeing ID and documentation restrictions that make it harder for people to work, travel, vote, or even pick up their prescriptions. We are seeing drag bans written so broadly that they effectively criminalize trans people for existing in public. And here is another layer of hypocrisy that is impossible to ignore. The same political and media ecosystem that obsesses over trans people using bathrooms and drag queens, reading books in libraries, often seems strangely quiet about actual documented abuse. Decades of sexual abuse scandals in the Catholic Church, powerful men connected to Jeffrey Epstein and other trafficking networks, real systematic harm to children. Somehow, story time at the library becomes a bigger threat than institutions that have covered up abuse for generations. That tells you something important. This is not really about protecting kids. It's about choosing convenient targets that cannot fight back. Let's talk a little more about gender-affirming care, because the way this phrase gets used is incredibly misleading. Gender-affirming care is not some strange, niche thing only trans people get. Most of us use it or know someone who does. Braces to strengthen teeth, hair transplants or hair removal, breast implants or breast reductions, testosterone for low T, estrogen for menopause, Viagra and similar medications, reconstructive surgery after cancer. Even something as simple as a haircut or clothing that helps you feel more like yourself fits under the broad idea of aligning your body and how you experience yourself. We do this all the time, we just don't call it gender-affirming care when cis people do it. And when it comes to trans healthcare specifically, major medical organizations support it. The data shows regret rates are low. The idea that this is a reckless or experiment is a political story. It's not a medical one. None of this is about evidence-based medicine. None of this is about real safety. This is about using trans people as symbolic enemies in a culture war. Be serious. If exposure were all it took, a whole lot of queer and trans adults would not have spent years or decades surviving families, schools, churches, and workplaces that were actively hostile to them. This is the same old social contagion myth we've seen before about gay people, yes, about left-handedness, and about interracial marriage. Visibility goes up and suddenly people claim identity is being created. People do not become trans because they heard about it or because someone used different pronouns. People come out because they finally have a language or safety or enough room to stop pretending. And there are a lot of contradictions that I want to talk about. We have seen repeated online reports of Grindr usage spikes around big conservative political gatherings. We've also seen millions of monthly searches in the US for transgender-related adult content, including in places that publicly pass anti-trans laws or run anti-trans campaigns. No one knows why any individual searches what they search. but it does show something very human. Public panic and private reality often do not match. And speaking of selective outrage, let's talk about names and pronouns. We're told it's too hard, it's too confusing, it's too much to ask to call trans people by their names or use their pronouns. We're told that names are fixed, sacred, unchangeable. Meanwhile, J.D. Vance was born James Donald Bowman. He later became James David Hamill, and then became James David Vance, taking his grandparents' last name, before eventually branding himself as J.D. Vance. That is three or four different names over one lifetime. And somehow, that's just his personal choice. No panic, no legislation, no hearings about the collapse of society. There's also federal policy. On January 20th, 2025, Donald Trump signed an executive order titled Defending Women from Gender Ideology Extremism and Restoring Biological Truth to the Federal Government. In it, he declared that the federal government would only recognize two sexes, male and female, and that gender identity would not be recognized by federal agencies. Trump said, quote, as of today, it will henceforth be the official policy of the United States government that there are only two genders, male and female. A week later, on January 27, 2025, Trump signed another executive order titled Prioritizing Military Excellence and Readiness, directing the Department of Defense to revise policies to exclude people who identify with a different gender from their biological sex. Following that, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth issued directives halting enlistment of transgender people and suspending gender-affirming care for service members. On May 7, 2025, Hegseth said at a public event, quote, no more pronouns, no more dudes in dresses, we're done with that. On May 8, 2025, after the Supreme Court allowed enforcement of the ban, the Pentagon announced that transgender service members diagnosed with gender dysphoria would have 30 days to voluntarily separate from active duty and 60 days for reserves or face involuntary separation. Let's be clear about what this means. Trans and gender diverse people serve in the United States military. They always have. They serve as pilots, medics, intelligence analysts, mechanics, logistics officers, infantry. They deploy, they train, they bleed, some of them die. They swear the same oath. They carry the same gear. They take the same risks. They're willing to give their lives for this country. But apparently, they're not allowed to be themselves while doing it. They can be trusted with weapons. They can be trusted with classified information, which our president cannot be. They can be trusted with other people's lives, but they can't be trusted to know who they are. If someone can fight for your freedom, they should not have to beg for their own dignity. So let's be honest about what actually is happening here. It's not about bathrooms, it's not about kids, it's not about safety. This is about who gets to exist in public without having to justify themselves. Trans people, non-binary and gender expansive people, intersex people, all being told in different ways that their existence is up for debate, that they need to explain themselves, that their lives are a political problem instead of a human reality. Which brings us to today's episode title, Why Are Trans People Forced to Justify Their Existence? And before we go to our guests, let's talk about the word people love to throw around like it's a law of physics. The word normal. This is normal, that's not normal, be normal. First of all, who exactly made you the normal queen or the normal god? Was there a coronation, a ballot measure, a very boring convention? Here's the truth. What is actually normal is diversity. It always has been. Biologically, historically, culturally, human beings come in an absurd number of variations. That's not a bug in the system. That is the system. And it's not just humans. Nature is full of this kind of diversity. There are fish that change sex depending on their environment or their social group. Clownfish do it. Wrasses do it. A wrasse is also a type of fish, by the way. I had to look it up. There are reptiles where sex is influenced by temperature rather than chromosomes. There are birds with mixed sex characteristics in the same body. There are mammals that show same-sex bonding, courtship, and long-term relationships. Penguins, dolphins, lions, giraffes, sheep. The list is long, and it's very well documented. Intersex traits also show up in species. Nature does not run on a neat two-checkbox form. It never has. The world is messier, more interesting, and way more creative than that. There's a documentary called Animal Pride, and I say this with great affection. A cute scientist, nature nerd, Connell Bradwell. In the movie, Connell looks at same-sex behavior, sex-changing species, intersex traits, and the sheer variety of ways life expresses itself across the animal kingdom. This isn't ideology or politics, it's biology. And it's the world as it is. This brings me back to something very simple, the social contract of being an American. The idea is pretty simple. I let you be you, and you let me be me. My trans and non-binary friends do not spend their days telling other people that they're not normal or they shouldn't exist. They're not chasing down the preacher with an alcohol problem and a mistress. They're not yelling at the 80-year-old millionaire who married a stripper in Vegas. They're not holding interventions for families with six kids and counting who can barely take care of one. They're not obsessed with policing other people's lives. They just want to live theirs. I will tell you what is not normal. Hate. Obsession with other people's bodies. Panic dressed up as concern. Laws built on fear. That is the weird stuff. Religion and humanity are not meant to be separate. If your faith requires you to deny someone else's dignity so that you can feel righteous, that is not morality. That is control. And so here we are, not debating biology, not debating history, not debating reality. We're debating whether some people get to exist without apologizing. And that's not a policy question, that's a values question. My guest today is someone who has spent years working at the intersection of belonging, identity, power, and culture, helping society move past fear and towards something that actually looks like dignity. Rhodes Perry is the founder and CEO of Rhodes Perry Consulting, the best-selling author of Belonging at Work and Imagine Belonging, and a leading voice in what it really takes to build cultures that are rooted in safety and trust. Well, hi, Rhodes.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for being on this podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Of course. So for people who are meeting you for the first time, can you share a little...
Yeah.
For people who are meeting you for the first time, can you share a little bit about your journey and what led you to focus your work on belonging and culture?
Yeah. Well, that's a big question. So I'm really excited to be here on the show. And for folks that don't know me, what's important to know is that in my work, I help leaders build spaces of belonging from the inside out. So I'm a somatic coach. I work with a lot of executives right now who are dealing with chaotic times, and the old kind of scripts, the old ways of leading aren't working. And so really returning to kind of body-based practices to find ground with what is coming at us, like the same old pressures and now these new ones. And giving somatic-based skills on how to do that, which I really like. And it's interesting how I got here because I started my career in government. You know, I had a long career in public service, and I worked at the DOJ, I worked at the White House, I worked for New York City. And a lot of that was around basically doing, you know, a public policy work around programs that were like income maintenance programs, so Social Security, disability benefits, like things that are kind of being attacked right now. And I love that work. You know, I mean, that's what I was trained in to do at that time. And every organization that I worked at, you know, for myself, you know, I'm a transgender man, I'm bisexual, you know, there are a lot of kind of systems in place in these organizations that I just kind of ran into walls, you know, and I was really fortunate where I worked at, specifically like just with like the supervisors, the people that I worked with who were willing to kind of look at some of these barriers, like things around healthcare or just like bathroom usage and things like that, that, you know, and this was like over 20 years ago, willing to kind of say, hey, you're worth it. You're a really good employee. Let's find a solution to this. And so I'm just kind of sharing some of that story because that's kind of the beginning of how I got into the work that I do, which is kind of looking at organizations that have values and they want to attract the best people to work in the organizations. And sometimes those values get tested because there are things that people didn't look out for, like barriers that are challenging. And so really fortunate to have had those kind of supervisors and an accumulation of like 15, 20 years of working for different organizations and employers, like you start to see patterns over and over again. And I was like, wait a minute, maybe I could start helping organizations look at being more inclusive. And at that time, you know, it was just like around LGBTQ plus inclusion, primarily because in my journey of being an employee, I worked for a number of national LGBTQ organizations around employment opportunities for our communities. And so I was like, okay, I have these skills. So like, let me help out different organizations and really help them have cultures that are doing what they want them to do, right? Which is making the mix work, right? You have lots of different people from lots of different backgrounds. And that when people can perform and storm, work through conflict, usually conflict around ideas and approaches, you get really good performance over time, right? And it's challenging. Like a lot of people don't like, I mean, we live in Portland, so there's a lot of artificial harmony here, right? That I think that, you know, you got to move through that to get through some kind of conflict that's going to get you to a place where, wow, like we're stronger together because we had some friction and we can do some really great things. So anyway, that's kind of like some of like...
Yeah, no, that's great. You know, I'm kind of curious about your childhood. I'm also kind of curious about when you knew you were trans and what your transition looked like, if you feel comfortable talking about that.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I, you know, we talked before a recording of like agreeing to do a show to kind of talk around, you know, obviously what I do in the world, but also who I am. And I like to talk about being trans. I'm an open trans man because there isn't a lot of visibility for our communities in general and certainly for trans masculine people. So, yeah, I mean, when did I know? I mean, I think I was confusing when I was a young person. I have an older brother and he's 2 years older than I am. So from the time I was born until I was like five, I'm like, okay, this is cool. We're just brothers and we play. And, you know, I mean, I was kind of dubbed a tomboy growing up. So for viewers or listeners, you know, I was assigned female at birth, but obviously that assignment didn't really work out for me. And, yeah, so the, you know, kind of being dubbed as a tomboy in our culture bought me some time to still be able to express and wear clothing that was more masculine. I grew up in Florida in a suburban area in the 80s and 90s. So not at zero queer visibility, you know. I mean, I just didn't have access to any kind of mentors or anything like that. There were no inclusive schools, right? And so it was more kind of like socially, how do I survive? And this is all subconscious. And so, you know, from like middle school until I graduated, it was really clear, like, I just need to kind of like keep my head down and do really good in school and play sports. And so for me, sports was a huge refuge. So I played like every kind of sport possible, you know, which was great because for, you know, going to school, especially in high school, you can wear your uniform and there was some freedom in that, but it was basically hiding. There was a lot of masks and I wasn't even aware of anything because I was so focused on, I was in Florida and I wanted to get out of that state as much as possible. So I was like, okay, just do good in school, maybe get a scholarship in sports. And eventually I went to Notre Dame, which is, for anybody listening, if you're not familiar with that school, it's Catholic. And it's a really good school, but it's also really conservative, and that's not who I am.
Did you grow up somewhat religious? Or?
Yes, yeah. Grew up Catholic, recovery now, and yeah, you know, and I'm very spiritual, you know, and like, you know, I had a hard time squaring with the Catholic Church of like, okay, is there any like female pronouns in the Bible at all? You know, I would always ask that to my dad. You know, he'd be driving home from mass and he would be like, oh, you know, he and him, it means everyone. I was like, sure, dad. Okay. Like, I just, yeah. So yeah, that, but that, you know, my faith was important to me. I went there and that's where like just the unraveling, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like that's what college is about.
Was there anybody at Notre Dame who was also trans or going through transition that like,
no,
you know, it seems like that must've felt like you were all alone.
Yeah. 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 And you know, and it was like, when I first was coming out, I was like, oh, this is about my sexuality. You know, I was like, I'm a lesbian, you know, like, okay, that totally makes sense. And like, and it was fast, like things happened fast. So it wasn't like I came out this way and then I came out again, you know, and it was more around my gender identity. It was just, it got me closer to realizing, oh, this is really about gender. And in college, I kind of got into drag kinging, you know, which was fun, you know, and this was in like South Bend, Indiana. So like the community, it was like, it was kind of like everybody, you know, it was kind of, we all looked out for each other because the community was so small. And it was just really fun to play around and kind of like figure out who I was, how I wanted to express myself. And it was a safe place to explore gender. And when I was doing it, I was like, oh, this is not like, this isn't campy. This isn't like for like a performance.
You felt like
this,
you.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And it was awesome, you know, because it like brought me back when I was a little kid. You know, it's one of those memories that I don't really think about all that much now, but I just remember like when my parents were away, I would go into my dad's closet and put on his tie and like pretend like I was shaving, you know? So it's like, you know, it's like you kind of look back on your history and it all makes sense. But as you're living it, it's like, where am I? What am I doing? Who am I? And
so you were in college and you said you kind of unraveled or things unraveled.
Yeah.
What was that process like? Did you admit to yourself, like, this is who I am? I mean, what, how, like, explain to me and to listeners kind of what went on then?
Yeah. Yeah. So unraveling. So what I mean by that, because I think this is important, is like what I wanted in college was to go away and to really figure out who I was and what I believed in, you know? And I thought like, okay, that's what you do in college, right? Not everybody does that, right? But that was kind of an intention that I had. And when I got there, you know, it was a couple of things. Like first, it was kind of like still, you know, I was still so focused on school that I was not like, I just was not interested, you know, and was like, I don't understand why people are dating or whatever. I was like, what is wrong with me? And I remember one of my closest friends, he's a gay guy, and he was a part of this like fringe group at Notre Dame that wasn't even recognized by the student association. And it was called Outreach ND. You know, I was like, what's this about? And he's like, oh, it's like an LGBT advocacy group. I was like, cool, I'm going to go as an ally. Right. And I remember going as an ally, but it was really kind of like, once I was there, I was like, I think this is about me, you know? Mm-hmm. And, yeah. And I think that meeting, you know, I can still remember the building. I can still remember the people there, but that was the moment that the person who was leading it, she ended up becoming my first girlfriend. But of course, like she was like the number one advocate on campus. I was like, I want to be that. I want to do that. How do I do that? And that, you know, it was just, I started just to ask more questions, right? Like, why is this group not recognized on campus? All of the other groups are, they get tons of money. The school has tons of money. Like, why are they not funding this? You know, and at Notre Dame, even now, I think it's still like the spirit of inclusion. Mm-hmm. These words, right? These values, right?
And well, it's that expression. What is it? There's no love like Christian hate.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it just is like, it just felt so, I don't like that kind of contradiction. And so, you know, it was a point for me of like, I have a lot of friends who are queer I have, you know, some very close friends who are trans and non-binary and are Catholic and are in the Catholic institution trying to slowly evolve it. And I respect that. I very much respect that. Personally, for me, I couldn't square pouring so much of my soul, right? Like my spirit energy into an institution that kind of was holding its nose and like, we'll accept you if you like, with all these caveats. I'm like, no, that's not, you know, I got into more meditation, Shambhala meditation, like later in life. And there was this kind of, it was just like a paradigm shift where it was like, instead of original sin, like you're born with original sin.
I was going to talk about that, like, they are okay with that, but they don't believe that you are created as you are.
Yeah. I mean, all of that, like the original sin stuff on the Christian side of things. And then in Buddhism, there's this trait of like basic goodness. You're basically good. I'm basically good. I was like, what? We're all just okay.
You mean thinking of a newborn baby being a sinner is?
Yeah.
There's another option?
Yeah, there's another option. Like we could just choose like to recognize like we're all basically good. And yeah, so that was just kind of the beginning.
Did you, you know, then come out to your family? Like how, like tell
many
us
times,
about that.
Yeah. Many times. I mean, the first time I came out, don't recommend this, but I came out like, I don't know, I was 19. So it was like after I was coming back home for the summer and it was Memorial Day weekend. And I was like, I'm just going to write this 20-page letter of like detailing everything about like my process and just leave it for my parents to read. And then I went to go see my girlfriend who lived a couple hours away.
You just left it on like the kitchen table?
Yeah. Yeah. And then I came back and it was, you know, it was a whole thing. And it took my parents probably, you know, I mean, they said some okay things, but it took them about, you know, a decade to kind of get around.
Was it like, that's not true, this is a phase? Like, what were the...
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, was it
you're going to hell? Like what was their sort of reaction? Stemmed in?
No, you know, so like it later in my career, like I'm kind of jumping around a little bit, but I did a lot of work with LGBT youth and we did work around family acceptance. And I think something that's helpful for your listeners is like, you know, any kind of language like that is not accepting. So if you're coming out to someone that you love and their response is less than embracing of you, it's still seen as family rejection. And so much so, like your brain can't sort this out, but it's like, oh, I guess we'll accept you, or worse, like, you know, verbally saying something is akin to like kicking someone out of the house, like in terms of the pain that kind of creates in your brain. So just kind of providing,
well, it's a tough choice too, because your choice is to risk your whole world falling apart or to be yourself. I mean, what kind of choice is that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, yeah. I mean, so kind of like the things that they said, you know, my mom was like, I'll love you no matter what. That was the first thing that she said with tears in her eyes. And then there was a lot of other things of like her going back to when I was younger, you know, and kind of equating at the time, like my sexual orientation of being attracted to women at that time to like me being a boy. Like, so she was confusing my sexual orientation at that time with like my gender. And I wasn't yet ready I wasn't even kind of thinking about my gender at that point. She was already there, you know? So it's like kind of parents know something, like even if they don't have the right words, they don't have support.
Also, when people transition, they seem happier. They seem comfortable in their skin. Like that's who they were supposed to be, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It's like we're just like slowly unmasking more and more, you know. And I think like,
Was anybody in your family like absolutely not? I can't talk to you, or you know, or potentially made an excuse not to see you or stopped calling you.
No. So. So one, okay, so just to kind of go back, because I want to kind of like So I think like just for anyone listening, if you have a loved one in your life who is a part of the LGBTQ plus community, like if someone comes out to you, you know, it's just like, thank you so much for sharing that. You know, you trust me, right? Like that's like the best thing you could say. And also like, if you're not ready to say that, go get support, like go work your stuff out before you like have an interaction with someone who's like revealed something that really, you know, they want to receive, they want that to be held with care. Right. Mm-hmm. So anyway, just want to kind of my PSA on that. In terms of family, like no one did those things that you had asked about. My dad, like definitely my dad, you know, it took him like a decade to kind of like really wrap his arms around the fact that, well, like for the first year or so, like he had someone who's just queer, you know, like a lesbian daughter in his eyes. Right. But then quickly after that, it's like, oh, you have another son. Right. And for both of my parents, I think they were just grieving like the life that they thought that they wanted me to live. Mm-hmm. Right. And up until that point, like I was kind of like people pleasing for mm-hmm. them. I was doing the things that they wanted me to do. Right. And it was kind of me kind of in that moment of coming out at 19, kind of putting a stake in the sand of like, this mm-hmm. is who I am. It's like what you do as a teenager. Mm-hmm. Like you become your own individual. Mm-hmm. And it's, yeah.
Well, and some parents, you know, are potentially awful. They kick their kids out. I mm-hmm. mean, and I think you kind of alluded to this. There's people that are not necessarily on board or don't understand, but they potentially still have the ability to learn, or they still love you.
Yeah.
I think we sort of throw everybody into one category.
Yeah.
But you know, you raised a good point about your parents want you to be something and to fulfill a story, but then you also get parents to say, you know, I just want my child to be happy and healthy.
Yeah.
And so, yes. Yeah, I'm happy yeah. and healthy as myself.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And they like, they got there, right? But they didn't have support. Didn't have support. And they're not group people anyway. PFLAG existed at that time, and it certainly existed in the area where I grew up. And I worked there later in my life. They have never joined anything like that.
I mean, I know we're in Portland and it's a bubble, but have you ever... you know, back then or now faced discrimination, and what did that look like and how did it make you feel?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's subtle. I mean, early in my career, I was transitioning. I mean, this was like one of my first jobs, and I was working for an LGBT organization. So here we go with this, but I mean, this was like 2000-ish, right? So it like LGBT was still kind of silent. Mm-hmm. B was kind of tolerated, you know what I mean? And the woman that I was working for, she's butch, she's a cis woman, she's no longer alive, so RIP, rest in power. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, I had only been working there for like a month or two, and I had shared with her, I was like, this is really important to me, I'm gonna need to take some time off. I'm getting top surgery. Mm. Right. And like, you know, she was initially supportive of that. And then throughout like the kind of weeks after sharing that, she was giving me coaching of like how I needed to be more like a man, how I needed to talk differently, how I needed to express in kind of, in my opinion, pretty toxic ways.
As if you were playing like a character in a play or.
Yeah. Yeah, that I had to perform masculinity in a very narrow way. And that, and like when I was transitioning, I was like, hell no. You know, I want to be as like flamboyant as I am, or not, you know, I just wanted to be myself and not change that, you know, basic goodness. Yeah. And I've only been fired once, and I was fired in that job by my, you know, someone within like our broader community. And it was very, very, very painful. You know, and I was really young at the time, and I just remember like the next day going back to this organization because I had to turn in keys and just, I remember sharing with her, I was like, look, like I really, really believe in this organization and its mission. And, you know, think you have some learning edges, you know? And I just, I felt like it was just a moment of dignity mm-hmm. where I was like, you're not gonna, like, you're not taking mm-hmm. me. You're not gonna, like,
well, yeah. Well, in the trans and non-binary issues, they remind me of what I talk about in almost everything, which is, like, the social contract of America, which mm-hmm. is, if I'm gonna let you be you, you're gonna let me be me.
Yeah.
And so we have a weird sense in America where people want to tell people who they can be.
Yeah.
You know, and the main question for this is, like, why do trans people have to justify their existence? Hmm. And, you know, you can answer that, but the reality is like, nobody should have to do that.
Yeah. Period. Period. We could just be basically good. And I think where that comes from is that people just, one, they don't understand gender, right? It's just like, it goes down to kind of biological essentialism, where it's like, I was assigned this at birth, my anatomy is this, and therefore I'm going to accept this script subconsciously. Like, people don't think about it.
And you're going to be dressed in pink or blue. And
for most of the time, the majority of people just don't think about it. And so for those of us who have spent, like, our entire life thinking about it, because it's not, that script wasn't working for us, right? Like, in some ways, like, what I think the trans agenda is just giving people more freedom to have more choice. You know, you have choice. If you like the script and it works for you, awesome, right?
Yeah. But why are people so bothered? I mean, it's like, what are trans people doing to you? I know there's the worry of, like, trans people in sports or trans people grooming their kids. During the election, they were saying, like, Kamala wanted to turn people trans, or they acted as if, like, your child goes to school and meets a trans person and comes back home trans. But, like, why are people who are so transphobic obsessed with trans people? Like, why do you feel like that is? Do you know?
I think what you're talking about when we're just talking about political rhetoric, those things, the people that made those commercials knew that it was, like, the most sensational lie ever. And it was something that would scare people to, it was something that could be a catalyst for behavior of getting them what they needed, which was mm-hmm. a vote. And also an extension of what I see, you know, maybe people want to debate me, but, like, this kind of rise of global fascism. And there's someone that I deeply admire as a scholar, Judith Butler. They wrote a recent book. They've written many books, but it's called Who's Afraid of Gender? And it's talking specifically about what you're asking. Like, why are people so, around the world, like, dictators, people with lots of money, billionaires, like, targeting trans people? And it's not about us. It's classic scapegoating, mm-hmm. and it's an appendage of fascism, right? Like, if we can kind of target more people to point the finger as we kind of grift and steal money from people and say, mm-hmm. oh, trans people, they have so much power. They're the ones making your life shitty. Go get them. Like, mm-hmm. most people don't understand who we are, right? So it's very easy for the public, like the masses right now, trying to wrap their arms around trans mm-hmm. people. They have a conversation with me. We have a great conversation. Trans people are great.
Yeah.
You watch a stupid commercial that's political rhetoric for one side of a two-party system, and all of a sudden they get swayed the other direction, and it's almost like seagrass just going back mm-hmm. and forth of getting swayed. And I think that the ground is still fertile enough and kind of, like, porous enough for more conversations like these to happen. Mm-hmm. To really have a real conversation with a live human being who happens to be trans.
Sure.
To understand.
And just honing in on their capacity to love. Like, if you're telling me you're a good Judeo-Christian or patriotic, or you're a loving person, seeing someone as they are is a loving thing. Mm-hmm. Seeing someone as somebody who should not exist as they are is not pious at all. It doesn't seem patriotic, but it doesn't seem loving.
Yeah.
So you, you know, you do this work, and I know that you talk a lot about belonging. Can you just explain, you know, DEI now is used as an enemy word, or woke is used as an enemy word, but you know, there's DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion. There's also belonging. And then sometimes we also talk about justice. So can you just describe the difference between DEI and then DEI with belonging, and how those sort of words or verbiages relate to the time that we're in or where we're going?
Yeah. I mean, everything that you're talking about are all just strategies, right? These are ways of talking about a kind of pluralistic society, right? And, you know, for some of us, that we want a pluralistic democracy where people can participate in this franchise that's the United States, or for other democracies around the world. And in my opinion, I think why all of these things, all of those things that you just shared, are being attacked right now is because they are tools, they are strategies for peace, right? Like, if you want hard power, what's going to get in the way of that? Well, people kind of recognizing, wait, I see the humanity in you, you see the humanity in me. I'm not going to debase you for who you are, but like, I don't really agree with you. Can we talk about that? Right? Like, that's basically all those words you just said are different kind of angles to do what I just shared of like talking across difference and conflict in ways that don't dehumanize. And so when you have, right, like a regime, an administration, whatever you want to call what's happening in DC, that wants to accumulate so much power, they need to scapegoat, they need to point fingers at a small number of people to kind of take what they want and then distract. So that's that. With diversity, equity, and inclusion, belonging, you know, these are things to talk about ways of building that pluralistic democracy, in my opinion. So, you know, and they're all outcomes. You know, I really like Lily Zhang. You know, they have written a lot around just trying to be more rigorous in how we talk about these words, because they're not synonymous. So just for your audience, like diversity, it's a people outcome, right? Different people. If you're in a group, there's different people, it's diverse, right? That's a diverse outcome. And you can always increase that or decrease that. Inclusion is a behavioral outcome. So there's ways we can be inclusive in this interview through our language and the ways that we kind of interact. And there's ways we could be exclusive, right? So that's a behavioral outcome. In equity, people seem to kind of like, I don't understand equity. It's just a system outcome, right? So if you think about, I don't know, Social Security, right? Like, you know, if we want to give people what they need, people may get different amounts, right? And that's being equitable, right?
Giving people what they need versus giving everybody, it would be like you're giving out blankets downtown to people who are houseless, and everybody gets one blanket, but one person already has four.
Exactly.
And so why give the person with four blankets another blanket when you can give someone without a blanket?
Yeah.
A blanket.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that's like DEI. That's somehow like, I just don't understand, like, one, why all those words get used in the same way, and two, why this is hard to wrap our arms around, other than I think people intentionally wanting to be ignorant because it bumps up against a worldview that's not theirs, right?
And belonging, I mean, I think that's a beautiful word, like belonging. If you feel like you belong, there's so much in that.
Yeah.
I guess explain to me what that means, whether it's belonging to a community, belonging at a workplace, why it's really important that.
Yeah.
I mean, other than, you know, there was a time a couple years ago where everyone just sent out a DEI statement and some people hired, you know, a Black person or a queer person. And so my guess, and of course I want to know from you, is like, belonging is like, you don't just do the thing to check a box. You have to make sure that this real live person feels like they're part of the team and that they have opportunities presented to them.
Yeah. So like, just like going back to the outcome conversation, belonging is an emotional outcome, right? And so it's an emotional outcome for us to feel when these strategies are happening. Like if our team is starting to reflect more of the communities we live in, if I'm feeling like I have a seat at the table and I can actually engage without any kind of negative consequence, and I'm getting what I need to succeed, I'm going to start to feel more safe, you know, to take interpersonal risk. I'm going to start to kind of like give more trust to leaders because they're trusting me. And that's going to create the conditions to feel that emotional outcome of belonging. But you've got to have safety and trust before everyone's like, oh, we love belonging. It's like, great. Are your people safe enough to take interpersonal risk, ask for help, admit to a mistake, you know? And do you know? You know, and most of the time it's assumptions. Oh, everyone's safe. Everyone belongs. It's like, well, maybe do an audit. Maybe ask.
I think part of this is like not every trans person's monolithic.
Mm-hmm.
Just like anybody of any identity, they're not all the same. So
yeah.
And I think, you know, they're treating people that way. There's a hateful component, but there's also, you've just never met a trans person. It doesn't mean you should assume they're evil, which is awful, but it means that you should ask them how they're doing and learn from them and vice versa. So I guess my question for you is, how should someone approach safely? Because I feel like we live in this society now where it's like we're so used to hate, it's normalized.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's people who want to try to like or try to love, but they're so worried about doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, if I do this, that's going to get me canceled. Or if I do this, I'm going to say the wrong thing and that's going to hurt this person.
Yeah.
So the people who actually care and want to embark on being better humans, can you give some kind of advice on what are some ways you talk to a trans person and what are some ways that, you know, don't do that?
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, right, it's going back to what you're saying, like you're talking with another human being, right? And maybe it's because of the work that I do, but I try to check like whatever like that lizard brain is saying of like trying to put someone in a category. I'm like, okay, like once I have a conversation with this person, I wonder how many of these assumptions I'm going to be wrong about, you know? And it's just kind of like, just be curious about like with any human, right? Like what's their story, you know? Like I see them, but like there's a lot, you know, it's almost like, you know, that saying, still waters run deep. You know, if you treat it like an interview where you just genuinely want to get to know someone and it's an exchange, I think that's the place to start.
Meaning that being trans is one part of their identity, but they have a favorite color and they have a favorite food and they like to do things for fun. And
totally. Absolutely. Just like all of us, right? It's just like, I mean, for anyone listening, you have a gender, right? But how much does your gender like kind of like dwarf everything else that you are? Probably, you know, it has influence, right? But it's not the only thing, right? And so I think that's the first thing. And you're asking something really specific, like as you're going deeper with someone who you're trying to build an acquaintanceship with, a friendship, a colleagueship, whatever it might be, is like how to be respectful. And I think it's always to allow people to share, you know, what they want to share, right? And that's kind of those like horizontal relationships. You kind of just move at the speed of trust, right? And it's a two-way street, right? It's almost like allyship, you know what I mean? Like there's times that I would need an ally or you need an ally, and we need to be in conversation of what that's actually going to look like. There's no checklist.
I really like when they say like allyship is a verb.
Yeah, it's a verb. And it's also like it's like a in the moment contract. Do you know what I mean? It's like I could be your ally. I could do something really awesome, but it doesn't mean I'm going to be able to like show up in that way. You know, it's like I really have to make a concerted effort again and again to just show, right? Instead of like giving myself like, oh, I'm such an amazing ally for these different communities and I'm a savior and whatever the thing is. Like you don't say it, you just do it.
How do you work with people who, you know, maybe the environment's conservative and not accepting, or, you know, everyone at the office accepts that, but there's one guy who says the most horrible things, you know, I guess kind of walk me through it. Is it, we don't want to like, we don't want to make it about the person who mm-hmm. is hateful sometimes, because then we take away from the person who's actually feeling the hurt or the pain.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that happens a lot in American society where it's like, instead of it's same thing with racism. Someone says something racist, and then now all we're talking about is we're arguing with this person who said something racist, whether or not they're racist or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the person who the comment was said to, we've sort of pushed aside for a second.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So I guess in a situation like this, if there's someone who is trans at work in a company, and there are some people are great and allies and loving, some people are hateful, and then some people are sort of, they're not yet there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you approach that?
It's situational, you know? So I feel like kind of in how you just presented that, there's a couple of different angles to it. Workplaces, I think, are the easiest to kind of address this, because if you're in a good organization, I hope you have values, you know, I hope you have team goals. I hope you have a mission of some sort. If you do, it's always easy to rally around, especially if you have values, like we're an inclusive organization, you know, we appreciate diversity, whatever the values are that are around your culture. When someone behaves in a way that runs afoul of what those values are, it's really easy to kind of like, one, if that person says or does something behaviorally that harms someone who, for whatever reason, right? But if, you know, in this case, if they're trans, you know, you want to isolate like the situation, you know, it's almost like the emergency room. It's like triaging.
Mm.
And first, like separate the bad behavior person from the person who's been harmed, and check in with the person who's been harmed. Hey, like that was said, how are you doing? I saw that, you know, and, you know, and just allow that person to have control over like, wasn't a thing for them. Number one, you know, maybe they have a relationship with this person, like who knows? So you've got to check in with the person who's been harmed and allow them to take the lead on what's needed, right? Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes in a workplace, it's like, I saw that behavior and I'm going to like come in and very publicly like shame this person who may or may not know that they just caused harm, right? And you had said like someone who's malicious versus someone who's just trying to, you know, they don't know what they don't know.
There's people who say, you know, it's confusing or too hard for us to have a gender neutral bathroom or say pronouns or be respectful. And I mean, you and I are decent human beings, so we know that that's bullshit. But like, I mean, one, can you highlight like what seem like small differences mean to someone who doesn't feel like they belong? And then also just like, what do you say to someone who, you know, there's people who call people by their dead name. There's people who say the wrong pronouns.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I know I'm asking you like three questions at once, but, like,
don't stack questions.
How do people at a workplace make sure that people belong? And then kind of tell me how, like, sometimes just these small things in practice are actually a big deal to someone who's at work and is uncomfortable or doesn't feel like they belong, but really the employer could just do these simple things.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let me share a story, which was like, this story blew me away. So when I was coming out and I was sharing with my dad that I'm trans, he's like, oh, and he said, so my dad, where I grew up was the Space Coast, right? So there's lots of engineers, and where he worked, there was a rocket scientist in like 1992. And she was transitioning. So she's a trans woman, but at the time she had not yet transitioned. And she was a great employee. They needed her to stay. So in 1992, I mean, this is pre everything that we're going through right now. The company was like, not only did they convert a bathroom to make it like basically an all user bathroom. That's what we would call it today. They made sure that she had the healthcare that she needed. They were able to quickly make shifts and changes in policies. And that policy, it still exists at this company. It's called Harris L3 now. And that policy was made in 1992, just like that. Wow. So if it's too hard.
So they saw her as a person and appreciate her skill set.
She was a rocket scientist. They didn't want to lose her. Like, how many rocket scientists are out there? So, I mean, and not every employee is a rocket scientist, but I would encourage people to recognize, like, your colleagues, you know, for the workplace context, right? Like, everybody's contributing something. They passed the grade. They got the job, right? They're on the team. They're supporting the team goal. You know, it would be like if someone has a different name that you've never pronounced before, you care about them. There's nothing sweeter than pronouncing someone's name correctly and like using the right pronouns for that person. That's basic human respect. Everybody has pronouns. Like, I just kind of laugh at like the guys who, you know, are just like, I don't understand pronouns. I don't have pronouns. I'm like, I think you'd be pretty upset if someone used she and her as pronouns for you.
What is one myth about trans people or gender diversity you wish that you could get rid of or disclaim?
I mean, there's a million, but I think like basic is like what you were just talking about. Like being trans is just an adjective that describes like one aspect of you. I think like, even in our own communities, people think that being trans is a sexual orientation or that we have no sexual orientation. You know, it's like gender identity, sexual orientation, right? Like they're things, right? But they're not the same thing.
Okay. So yeah. This is we've reached the point of the final segment.
Okay. All right. So
this is a segment called Why Is It Like This?
Okay.
So basically, we both name a person, place, or thing that could be better or should be better by now.
Okay.
You can go off on a system, a product, a norm, a situation. I'll go first.
Okay.
And then and it can be silly, serious. It can be whatever you want. So
okay.
I did this in a previous podcast, and it was about the handles on brown paper bags. So I have a similar one today, which is to-go boxes at hot bars and salad bars.
Okay.
So the to-go boxes at hot bars or salad bars, you can't get them out of, they're stacked.
Okay.
So what happens is you and everyone else is touching all of those to-go containers.
Okay.
And then if you're lucky enough to get one out, you kind of like throw four out with you. And then you get whatever salad or hot bar into that cardboard thing.
Okay.
It doesn't shut. You can barely shut the container.
Okay.
Like, so it's why is this like this is why can't we just have better to-go boxes that work? And if they were good, it wouldn't require the store clerk keep tape up front to make sure that your food doesn't fly all over your car.
Oh my God. Okay.
So that's mine. So what is yours? What is your, why is it like this?
You know, I saw that question, before we were recording this interview, and I was listening to, remember like Meat Pup or who is it? Meatloaf.
Yeah.
The band.
Yeah.
Objects in the mirror are closer than they appear. Right.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
That little, like that used to be on, that's not on, it's at least on my car. That's not on the rearview mirror. That's no longer there. The little warning.
Why?
I don't know why it changed, but that was
maybe they are what they appear.
Maybe they fixed, I don't know. I mean, it's still the same optical illusion, right? But they just removed the, anyway.
Yeah.
That's on Subaru,
but we need to figure that out. So that's your, why is it like this?
Why is it like it? Why did they change it? Do they want us to get in car wrecks more?
I don't know. Yeah. No, that's fascinating.
Yeah. Maybe they've improved it. But that was where my curiosity went.
Well, I really appreciate you being here.
Yeah.
How can people get a hold of you, find out what you're working on?
Yeah.
Can you tell us how to do that?
The easiest way, I have a website, rhodesperry.com. That easy. Yeah. And there's books, you know, if people are into the belonging conversation, there's a couple of books on that. And I have a new book coming out called Roads Less Traveled, not spelled like my name. And in that book, it goes into kind of like this next evolution of the work that I do and kind of recognizing if we want to change everything that's external to us, we have to do the inner work. And so that's mm-hmm. very much what the book is like. And if anyone's read The Artist Way, it's very structured in a similar way where it's like 12 chapters, but you're meant to go through it in 12 weeks.
Yeah.
So it's like a whole season.
Rhodes, you're asking people in America to do inner work?
I mean, you know, these are, it's not for everyone, but maybe, just maybe, for one listener today, it's for you. Yeah. But yeah.
Well, thank you for being you. Thank you for being here. Thanks for being amazing in our community and for doing this work.
Thank you.
Appreciate you doing this podcast.
Thank you for the invite. It's awesome. And I wish you a ton of success as you continue recording.
Yeah, thanks so much.
This was a lot of fun.
Well, we've reached the end of this episode of All American Why. If you made it this far, congratulations. You're officially an excessive thinker too. If something today made you laugh, cringe, or reconsider everything you thought you understood about this country, good. That's the point. Subscribe, rate, review, and share All American Why wherever you get your podcasts, including on YouTube. Or don't. It's still a free country for now. You can find me, Michael Jonas, on social media or at allamericanwhy.com, where we're building community for people who still give a damn. All American Why is filmed and recorded at X-Ray FM Studios in North Portland, Oregon. Original music by Renezra and Views. Audio editing by Kyle Gilmore of Residual Audio. Until next time, keep your curiosity loud, your optimism spiteful, and your democracy under constant surveillance. This is All American Why. Thank you for listening.
All American Why. All American Why. All American Why. Ask yourself the American Why. All American Why.